Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and later on Building Bridges, it's a class war and we're losing with Bill Moyers and Income Inequality Matters with Mezu Louis.
But first...
This is Chuck Collins from United for a Fair Economy in Boston. We've heard that there is a growing gap between the very wealthy and everyone else. What does wealth inequality sound like? The sound that you are about to hear is a BB falling into a metal soup pot. Each BB represents $500 in net worth. If we took all the private wealth in the United States and divided it evenly among all the 100 million households, each household's share would sound like this. That was the sound of 500 BBs, the equivalent of about $250,000 for every household. But as you know, wealth is not evenly distributed. If we were to take the wealth of the bottom 50 million households and average it out, here is what it would sound like. That was 10 BBs, the sound representing $5,000. On the other end of the spectrum, let's listen to the average wealth of the richest 1% of households. To join the richest 1%, you need to have about $2.6 million or more. Here's what their share of wealth sounds like. That was the sound of wealth inequality, where the richest 1% of households has an average of $10 million, and the average 50 million households in the bottom, over half the population, has an average of $5,000 in net worth.
And the question is, which side are you on? One of the questions of that is, how much money are you making, and what the inequality of income is? And we're going to have Bill Moyers address that question right now. It's a class war, and we're losing. Let's listen to Bill Moyers on that.
Official Washington no longer finds anything wrong with a democracy dominated by the people with money. Recall Roger Tamraz. You saw him on a documentary I did in 1996 called Washington's Other Scandal. There was another scandal going on in Washington in 1996. It had nothing to do with sex. Tamraz was the wealthy oil man who paid $300,000 to get a private meeting in the White House with President Clinton. He wanted to secure a big pipeline in Central Asia. This got him called before congressional hearings on the financial excesses of that campaign. He didn't think he had done anything out of the ordinary. He told the senators, look, when it comes to money and politics, you make the rules. I'm just playing by your rules. One senator then asked Tamraz if he had registered and voted, and he was blunt in his reply. No, Senator, I think money's a bit more important than vote. So what does that come down to practically? Let me read you one accounting. Quote, when powerful interests shower Washington with millions in campaign contributions, they often get what they want. But it's ordinary citizens and firms that pay the price, and most of them never see it coming. This is what happens if you don't contribute to their campaigns or spend generously on lobbying. You pick up a disproportionate share of America's tax bill. You pay higher prices for a broad range of products, from peanuts to prescriptions. You pay taxes that others in a similar situation have been excused from paying. You're compelled to abide by laws while others are granted immunity from them. You're barred from writing off on your tax returns some of the money spent on necessities while others deduct the cost of their entertainment. In contrast, this accounting goes on, the fortunate few who contribute to the right politicians and hire the right lobbyists enjoy all the benefits of their special status. Make a bad business deal, the government bails them out. If they want to hire workers at lower than market wages, the government provides the means to do so. Walmart got $1 billion in subsidy from local taxpayers over the years. It has been making $8 to $9 billion a year in profits. If they want immunity from certain laws, the government gives it. If they want to ignore the rules of competition that they would otherwise have to comply with, the government gives its approval. If they want to kill legislation intended for the public good, it gets killed. End quote. I'm not quoting from Karl Marx's Das Kapital. I'm quoting Time magazine. Time's premier investigative journalist Donald Bartlett and James Steele concluded in the series last year that America now has a government of the few at the expense of the many. Because economic inequality begets political inequality and vice versa. We're losing the balance between wealth and commonwealth. It's why we can't put things right. And it's the single most destructive force tearing at the soul of this country. The rich do not have the right to buy more democracy than anyone else. I know, this sounds very much like a call for class war. But the class war was declared a generation ago in a powerful paperback polemic by William Simon, who was soon to be Richard Nixon's Secretary of the Treasury. In that polemic, he called on the financial and business class, in effect, to take back the powers and privileges they had lost in the Depression and New Deal. They got the message, and soon they began a stealthy class war against the rest of society and against the principles of our democracy. They set out to trash the social contract, to cut workforces and their wages, to scour the globe in search of cheap wages, and to shred the social safety net that was supposed to protect people from hardships beyond their control. Business Week put it bluntly at the time, quote, "Some people will obviously have to do with less. It will be a bitter pill for many Americans to swallow the idea of doing with less so that big business can have more." The middle and working poor are told that what's happening to them is the consequence of Adam Smith's invisible hand, and this is a lie. What's happening to them is a direct consequence of corporate activism, intellectual propaganda, the rise of a religious orthodoxy that in its hunger for government subsidies has made an idol of wealth and power, and a long string of political decisions favoring the powerful and the privileged who bought our political system right out from under us. To put political muscle behind these ideas, they created a formidable political machine. During the 1970s, business refined its ability to act as a class, submerging competitive instincts in favor of joint cooperative action in the legislative area. Big political action committees flooded the political arena with a deluge of dollars, and they built alliances with the religious right, who mounted a cultural war that would serve as a smokescreen in the class war, hiding the economic plunder of the very people who were enlisted as foot soldiers in the cause of privilege. And they are winning. In a book to be published this summer, Daniel Altman describes what he calls as the neo-economy, a place without taxes, without a social safety net, where the rich and poor live in different financial worlds. And, said Altman, it's coming to America. Well, he's a little late. It's here. The savviest investor of them all, Warren Buffett, says, "My class won." Look at the spoils of victory. Over the past 3 years, they pushed through $2 trillion in tax cuts, almost all tilted toward the wealthiest people in the country. Cuts in income taxes, cuts in investment income, cuts in huge inheritances. More than half of the benefits of those cuts are going to the wealthiest 1%. You could call it trickle-down economics, except that the only thing that trickled down was a sea of red ink in our state and local governments, forcing them to cut services and raise taxes on middle class and working people. And now the Congressional Budget Office forecasts deficits totaling $2.75 trillion over the next 10 years. These deficits have been part of their strategy. 20 years ago, President Ronald Reagan's real strategy was to force the government to cut economic social programs by fostering federal deficits of historic dimensions. Reagan's own budget director, David Stockman, admitted as such. And now the leading strategist of the political right wing, Grover Norquist, says the goal is to starve the beast, government, with trillions of dollars in deficits resulting from trillions of dollars in tax cuts until the United States government is so anemic and so anorexic that it can be quietly drowned in the bathtub. The corporate conservatives and their allies in the political and religious right are achieving a vast transformation of American life in creating the greatest economic inequality in the advanced world. They have saddled our nation, our states, and our cities and counties with structural deficits that will last until our children's children are ready for retirement. And they are systematically stripping government of all its functions except rewarding the rich and waging war. If instead of practicing journalism, I was writing for Saturday Night Live, I couldn't have made up the things this crew has been saying. The president's chief economic advisor says shipping technical and professional jobs overseas is good for the economy. The president's Federal Reserve chairman says that tax cuts may force cutbacks in Social Security, but hey, he says, we should make the tax cuts permanent anyway. And the president's labor secretary says it doesn't matter if job growth has stalled because, and I quote, the stock market is the ultimate arbiter. And they have no shame about it. This morning I went online and read those transcripts of Enron traders discussing how they are manipulating the California power market in telephone calls in which they gloat about ripping off those, quote, poor grandmothers in the energy crisis 4 years ago. You can go online this evening when you go home and read how Citigroup has been fined $70 million for abuses in loans to low-income, high-risk borrowers, the largest penalty ever imposed by the Federal Reserve. A few clicks later, you can find the story of how a subsidiary of the corporate computer giant NEC has been fined over $20 million after pleading guilty to corruption in a federal plan to bring internet access to poor schools and libraries. And this, we are told, is just one piece in a nationwide scheme to rip off the poor. There's a class war going on, folks, fought from the boardroom down. You can't make this stuff up. You have to read and hear it to believe it. But what they are doing to the middle-class Americans and to the working poor and to the workings of American democracy calls for righteous indignation. It's something to get mad about. So I thought that the mass media would awaken Americans to the reality that this ideology of winner-take-all is working against them and not for them. I was wrong. We cannot count on the mass media. What we have to have late in this war, a war that we're losing, is a mass movement of people like you. So get mad. Yes, there's plenty to be mad about. Then get organized and get busy for the fight of our lives.
And you were listening to Bill Moyer, who is the host of PBS's Now, has come under a great deal of fire himself from more conservative voices and is really the only liberal voice that has a regular program on PBS. And he's getting mad and we're getting mad as we watch the growing income disparity. And one of the people now to speak with us, who was at the same conference that Bill Moyers was, is Meishu Louis, who is the executive director of United for a Fair Economy.
Hi, how are you?
Major, let's expand on what Bill Moyers was saying, and let's expand a little bit in terms of the figures, and also let's not just confine ourselves to the present, but talk a little bit about the past in the sense of, is this just Bush's doing?
Right. It's certainly not just Bush, although in some ways he is the culmination of a right-wing strategy that started back in the early 80s, so that this has been building up for 20-some years. It started with that wonderful president that we're about to get a holiday for, Ronald Reagan. But I just wanted to say that Bill Moyers talked about the budget, the United States budget being anorexic. On the other hand, it's also a big, bulky bully. he barely mentioned the war spending. So it's not that we have smaller government. We have bigger government when it comes to the military side of things. Almost 50 cents out of every dollar, tax dollar that you spend goes toward either the military or paying the debt, paying the interest on the debt, and half of that is the military debt. So I would just expand on what Bill Moyer said in that way.
It would be helpful to expand within the class structure as well and to understand how the disparity of income also affects people of color within that.
Yes, there really are two divides, and it's interesting because John Edwards got a lot of kudos talking about two Americas and said, let's have one America. And again, people of color in this country have known for a long time that there's not just one America, that there have always been two, three, many Americas with different rules operating for people of different colors. So if you look at just income for the moment, the income gap is still very big between people of color and whites. So actually, we did a study of the change for African Americans between 1968, the year Martin Luther King died, and today, and we found that in 1968, African Americans made 55 cents on the white dollar, and today they make 57 cents, a huge gain of 2 cents, and we figured that it would take 581 years for them to reach parity. So is that deliberate speed or what?
How does this work intergenerationally in terms of one generation being able to provide the opportunities for the next generation to basically close the divide?
Well, one thing that really hasn't been paid much attention to is the gap in assets or wealth. In other words, what you own minus what you owe, so that many people are stuck just looking for income, and a lack of income means you don't get by, so certainly income is critical. But if you have a lack of assets, you can't get ahead. So that there's a new book by Thomas Shapiro called The Cost of Being African American, where he compares black and white families with the same income. And he finds that that's really not a good measure of their financial well-being, because usually black families will have far less in terms of their assets, which means that, you know, their parents were not able to pay for their college education. They were not able to give them a down payment on their home. And rather than having Social Security or a secure old age themselves, the parents are actually a financial burden on their children. So these are all reasons why we still have a long way to go, and we need to pay attention to this wealth divide, and we need policies that don't just address raising income levels, but also look at the asset development side of things.
You know, one of the things that hit me about the conference that you spoke at and Bill Moyer's similarly is there was really not much that came out of it in terms of proposals during the time I was there in any event about what to do about this. As a matter of fact, one person in the audience says, well, what about putting a cap on CEOs? And what about nobody mentioned really equitable distribution of wealth. And yet they did talk about, at least Bill Moyers talked about class warfare, but I'm not sure what he meant by that other than we're getting killed by the upper class. So what do you begin to do? We know that there's this disparity of income, and yet people are not as angry, it would seem, as they should be.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that, and what do we begin to do about it?
Well, one thing that the right wing has used very effectively over probably the entire history of the United States has been to blame people of color for the economic difficulties of white Americans. So that, for example, right now, two myths are: one, that immigrants are a drain on the economy and should be stopped at the border, when in fact immigrants have been a real boost here in Massachusetts. If it wasn't for immigrant entry into Massachusetts in the 90s, we would have had a labor shortfall and we would not have had the economy that we have today. So that's a myth that needs to be dispelled. And certainly the myth that poor people, especially people of color, sort of the welfare queen image, are using too many of your tax dollars for government-funded services. But in fact, those services really are minimal, and they are not mostly used by people of color. So those are some myths that are being used. I think that right now, certainly what United for a Fair Economy is trying to do is to get people to see how the issue they are excited about, for example, it might be for students, the huge increase in the cost of college, or the fact that now there are very few scholarships, but you have loans now, so the government has switched its policy in terms of helping people get a higher education. That might be one issue, or for people who are looking at cuts to public education or cuts in Medicaid benefits, everyone is yelling, stop the cuts. But often they don't connect the cuts to the decrease in revenues due to the tax breaks that are being given to the wealthy. So one thing that really needs to happen is a longer-term educational process of helping people understand that when they vote for a tax cut, who does it really benefit and who does it really hurt? Because, for example, here in Massachusetts, a fairly middle-income family that voted for tax cuts might have gained $300 a year, but if they've got a child in a community college, the community college tuition went up by $500, so that's a $200 loss right there. So really helping people understand, you know, the revenue side of things, which is not the side most people think about. So that's certainly one thing. I think there are other venues where people are talking about policies. So there are a number of groups that are just starting to look at this issue of assets. For example, in England already, they passed a bill to create what are called baby bonds. Every child at birth receives $5,000. And as both the parents add to it, and sometimes there are private or public sources of addition to those funds, by the time the child is 18, that money has accumulated into a little chunk, and they can use it only for certain things like going to college or a down payment on a home or some asset-building activity. But in this country, we need to start looking at those things again as well. The GI Bill was a huge asset-building program applied mainly to whites. African Americans, for example, even though they served in the military, because of discrimination in universities and the housing market, were not able to get the same access to those benefits as white GIs returning from the war. So in some ways, we need a new GI Bill, or we need a new, as Martin Luther King said, an economic bill of rights this time that really not just includes but lifts up people of color in particular. I think that we really do have to pay attention to the racial divide. Simply by passing some universal programs, it's not going to address that particular problem, and we need to pay special attention to that. And that's one place where perhaps I disagree a little bit with Bill Moyers. I think that, you know, to talk just in general about class is not going far enough, that if we don't specifically talk about race, there will always be a gap. There will continue to be that gap between whites and people of color.
I just wanted to talk about not only inequality, but the growing inequality. And I know that we were talking about this even during the Clinton administration, when the inequality seemed to be growing, and now it seems to be exponential. How has this changed over time? And also, what do you expect to happen if we do change to a Kerry administration? Is there anything that makes you think that this would change if the Democrats got into power?
Well, certainly, for example, under Clinton, that was when the so-called a welfare reform bill was passed, the Personal Responsibility Act, which I like to call the Social Irresponsibility Act. No, the Democrats were not helpful in that way. I think with a Kerry presidency, we really are going to have to not give him any honeymoon, not assume that he's going to do anything differently. It requires public participation to force him to do the right thing. So, you know, right after he gets elected, we're going to have to get back in the streets to stop all the wars, spending, and to roll back the tax cuts from the wealthy, and then to specifically fund some of these kinds of programs that we're talking about that will start to close the gap. So I am optimistic only in that he's not totally crazy. We will have our work to
what
do.
A country.
There was a wonderful quote by Malia Lazu, who used to work here in the Boston Vote, where she said, "We have to say to Kerry, on Tuesday we vote for you, but the next Tuesday it's your ass."
Well, let me ask you this, Meiju Louis. Where can people find out more about the particular things that are being advocated by United for a Fair Economy?
Our website is www.faireconomy.org, and there's lots of interesting stuff there. We do a lot of popular education workshops because we think that economic policy, you know, you say a word like that and it just people's eyes immediately glaze over, but it really isn't that complicated. It really needs to be demystified. I feel like it's kind of like going to Oz and looking for the Oz the Great and Powerful, and then when you find out it's really just this little man manipulating some levers behind a screen. And I have to say, I always imagined that The Wizard of Oz looked a little bit like Alan Greenspan.
Now, that's a frightening thought. But, you know, one of the things that still hits me, and that is, here I go through an entire conference looking at fiscal and or financial inequality and discussion about class, and yet I never heard a single word about the redistribution of the wealth. Am I totally out of favor on that? Is that something that is just not possibly on the conscience and the consciousness of workers in this country to really effectively look at beginning to distribute the wealth differently?
I think that it, you know, right now I'm afraid that people sort of aspire. I think there was a Time survey that showed that a lot of people classified themselves as near rich, even though they had no hopes of ever getting anywhere close to that. But I think some of our TV shows, Everybody Wants to Be a Millionaire, has created this illusion that people can get there. I did a workshop once for high school age students, and they were ones who had not made it in the Boston Public Schools, so they were in an alternative classroom. And when I asked how many thought they would be a millionaire, a third of them raised their hands and truly believed it, which was a little frightening for me.
If we have large inflation.
Excuse me?
Only if we have massive inflation.
Really?
That's very sinister, Ken Nash.
Yes, well, what can I tell you?
But I think, you know, the tax issue is a good one in that when people realize that they pay taxes and that a lot of their taxes are going to support corporate breaks, tax breaks, and the wealthy, that's when they start getting mad, because then they realize that, you know, it's they want to have more control over their own dollars. They want them to see those dollars going into programs that will help them and their families and their communities.
Well, Meju Louis, we'd like to thank you for being with us on Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, and encourage our listeners to go to United for a Fair Economy's website and get more information. And I would agree with Bill Moyers on one thing. Get angry and organize. It's
Absolutely.
Been a pleasure.
Okay. Absolutely. Thanks okay. so much.
That's a class war.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Tune in next week for Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report.